Senior Focus. Welcome everyone. Kia ora tātou. I'm Anne-Marie Currie. I'm your presenter for this edition of Senior Focus. And our topic today is elder care, or the care of our seniors in the health system, and what are the people who have strategic oversight of the system saying about it. And I have with me in the studio Fiona Tanis, who is a physio and physiotherapist, and who is working with Inicio, a private company who are managing and advising at the strategic level across facilities, in communities and with government about the changes that we need. And they are really got their eyes open, and they're really very aware at the front line what has to move and what has to be done differently. So I thought that Fiona would be an excellent person to have a discussion with about the latest reports that have come out about the sector, in particular report from Carolyn Cooper, our aged care commissioner, our first ever aged care commissioner, and her first ever report. So it's a very seminal time to be looking at that review. And also we have had a report in the last month from Prudence Walker, who holds a very clear management role in the new Ministry for Disability within the Ministry of Social Development. So her report is quite interesting too, focuses on some things that overlap with what Carolyn Cooper's saying, but she also presents her own views as well, with a more disability-based focus, of course. So I want to kick off by just talking briefly about the three main foci that are in the report that Carolyn has done. I mean, she starts out with an executive summary. She presents the data on our changing population, what the demographics look like for the next 10 years. And of course, we on this program have talked a lot about this. We've talked about we're going to have almost one in four Aucklanders will be over 65 in the next decade, or by the end of the next decade. Her report focuses, of course, on the whole country. She's looking at a 20% benchmark for the over 65s within this decade. But she's highlighting the diversity and the enormous variance in language skills, cultural needs, and why we need to be more responsive at the coalface when we're looking at providing care and assessing how that care is being delivered. So she then moves on from the needs assessment to look at the gaps in the workforce, the shortages, the lack of training in gerontology for doctors and nurses and senior clinicians, the lack of awareness of the low-cost, innovative changes that can be brought in when you're not focused on expensive hospital care, but when your focus is in the community. So the workforce shortages limit, of course, what you can do. And so actually addressing those is both a funding issue and a cultural issue. But then there's also a third area which she focuses on as well, and that is how we need to get more collaboration and cooperation happening, and we need to have more resources in primary health care to facilitate all that. And in particular, she advocates for teams of doctors and nurses working in a practice to be able to join the dots and be able to work with pharmacists and be able to ensure that people are talking to each other, and decisions and changes are being shared when there's overlaps and when there's a need for understanding across the disciplines. So there's room for improvement. There are many models that have been begun, or there are pilots and there are projects out there, and she's able to talk about some of these, particularly the ones that are dedicated towards particular cultures. And I think she's done a good job in that part of the report. So I'm interested, Fiona, on how you see the gaps in the report, or how you see the situation in Aotearoa New Zealand currently. What do you see we need to have? What's your vision of the future?
Well, thank you for inviting me to join you today, Anne-Marie. I think the report's great. It's certainly highlighting very specifically the statistics for the elder care sector and around cultural and ethnicity situations where perhaps these people and these cultures are missing out on some level of care, particularly primary care. I think it also highlights that we need to collaborate a lot more, as you've mentioned. So we need to have a lot of groups of people involved in these sectors collaborating and talking and joining forces, so that we have more people involved with this instead of a whole lot of people trying to do their own thing or making a difference in their own little area. I feel very strongly about collaboration, coalitions, communication.
Yes, you mentioned to me in our conversation earlier about the National Cultural Change Coalition in the US. And I wondered if you'd like to talk more about the experiences of getting cultural change happening. And before we go there, it's not a matter of getting people who speak English to suddenly start speaking Māori. We're not talking about this sort of cultural change. We're actually talking about the way in which we focus on the person, and we're person-centred when we're delivering the care.
Absolutely. That's right. So, Culture Change Coalition, many states in America have their own Cultural Change Coalition, and we're looking at setting something similar up in New Zealand so that we can collaborate with different ethnicities, with different faculties around in medicine. We want allied health, we want dietitians involved, we want representatives from the care working force, from the registered nurse force. I think in that sense, we can only do or start a cultural change away from the traditional model. We want to bring people together. We want to look at person-directedness. We want to have the people we're caring for the centre of everything that we do. And I think we need a broad range of people involved in the coalition. And it's also an opportunity for people who would like to be part of something. We would want community members part of the coalition as well, because we need to hear what's actually happening in each of our communities, in the rural communities as well as cities. I think it's really important that we join forces across the whole of New Zealand in order to come to a place where we understand where we want to be. The report mm-hmm. that Carolyn Cooper's done is great, because it's highlighting what needs to be done now. It needs to happen now.
One of the things that struck me when I read the report was how we've got the horse before the cart, in the sense that our system currently is focused on funding hospitals, hospital care, and it's very high-level, very expensive intervention, which comes at the end of a line where we've ignored somebody for a long time while something's festered. And then it blows up, or the person falls, or the situation they're in changes and they can no longer cope. And then suddenly they're in the hospital, and there's someone's responsibility. Up to that point, they've been able to get away with doing nothing or having no intervention, because they're no one's responsibility. Somebody might want to get some help for them, but it doesn't always materialise, or it's short-term stuff. Here, take these tablets. and they have sent away. But what really needs to happen is we need person-centred care at the primary healthcare level, and it needs to be not necessarily expensive and not necessarily highly prescriptive, but we need to have the availability and the access there.
Well, that's right. Primary care, that's the key, really. And I think, I mean, that's struggling at the moment. We've got a GP shortage. There's not a lot of med students coming through the system that are choosing to become GPs. We don't have a lot of GPs who have the capability or ability, because they're working so hard, to take on younger doctors for training. The primary care nurses are not being paid as equally as the Te Whatu Ora nurses in the acute hospitals, so it's expensive to bring nurses on. So there's a whole lot of things that could make a difference. Practice nurses, we know from Carolyn's report that older adults over 85, if they regularly see a practice nurse, then they have less hospitalisations. So with the data's there, it's written in the report, it's known, so we need to put more resources into that primary care. We also need to consider too, when we talk about primary care or we're talking about community assistance and support services in the community, we need to ensure that the people who are working in these sectors are well trained, adequately trained to understand ageing, to understand dementia. There's a lot of information out there. A lot of people don't know how to access that information. I think we need to have that cultural change I'm talking about is about our workforce understanding what their role is, what is expected of them, how are they going to communicate, how are they going to look at people with ageing or perhaps a diagnosis of dementia, for families with people living with them who have dementia. We need a lot of work done in that sector too. If we can empower our workforce and empower people to understand more and educate more, then they as people are empowered and they will be able to empower the people they're trying to work with or are working with.
And at the moment, the biggest cry in this sector is the shortage of hospital beds.
In private facilities you're talking about?
Yes, the shortage of beds for dementia specifically. And I know of several cases recently where elders have been kept in a hospital at a cost of $500 or $600 a day for several months because there was no bed in the community that they could go to in a rest home.
That's right. Specialist dementia care, psychogeriatric dementia care, there are not as many beds as general hospital level of care. That's absolutely right. And it's very difficult for families trying to navigate this difficult situation that they're in. It's difficult for the acute hospitals, it's difficult for families, for those caring for these people involved. So that is a huge issue. And of course we all know our population is increasing, and with that increased population our elderly population is also increasing. People over 65 are increasing. We know that's going to get to big numbers, 22% of our population by 2040. We want people to age in place, as we call it, but we need adequate social support and support services. And a lot of people living with a disability, I think it's about 59% of people over 65 have been diagnosed or determined to have a disability. We need more beds for facilities because not all families can have people at home who require a higher level of care. A lot of people and baby boomers are working, they're much older than 65. So it's a very complex situation. And it's not just New Zealand, obviously, it's worldwide. So we do need to address all of those factors when we're looking at how we're going to improve our primary care.
Yes, and we as a country, the government has traditionally not provided any beds for dementia. So the retirement village industry has actually taken up the slack. They have actually, as a draw card to get people into the retirement villages, they say, oh, and we have a hospital wing over there. We have care beds available, care suites, so that if you progress to need that, you won't have to leave our facility. And of course that makes it more attractive for people to buy in and buy that licence to occupy, because they're not going to have to give it up. They can transfer it across to the care suite. It's a bit of a comfort when you're a couple, because if one of you goes into requiring care, you don't have to shuttle between two facilities, which can drive people batty.
Well, that it just adds to the stress. That's right. Although there is funding for dementia care within private hospitals. We just need more of those beds. And you're right, if you go into a retirement village and one of a couple requires a higher level of care, then most of the retirement villages do have a rest home or a hospital level of care within that community, but not all would have available beds as you may need it.
Hmm. And quite honestly, the actual sector, while it's done very well in its profit margins, it's moving into a different era, and some of the operators are no longer investing in these care beds because they find that it eats into their profit too much, and so they are actually curtailing the provision of beds. So they're actually having less beds per village, even though they're having higher numbers of people in the village.
Yes, I mean, Dr. Shane Retty, of course, has highlighted that too, that there's been chronic underfunding. Yes, that's right. So you've highlighted exactly what's happening as we speak.
Now, looking at the 20 recommendations that Carolyn Cooper's put together, and they are comprehensive and they are about many of the things that we've talked about that need to change. But one of the areas that she's really put a big red flag up on is the area of assessment of hearing and subsidy of hearing aids, because of the direct relationship between hearing and memory capacity, cognitive decline. And there is an opportunity, if you step in early with hearing loss and do the assessment early enough, you actually minimise the amount of hearing loss, but you also minimise the risk of moving into dementia. And you can actually reduce the dementia cases by about 22%. That's the average in the research. So the research highlights the relationship between the hearing loss, the memory decline, and the cognitive decline that's associated with hearing loss.
Well, hearing loss is one of the risk factors for dementia, that's right, along with cardiovascular disease, obesity, diabetes. So yes, and it's known, and Carolyn highlights that in her report too, around the ethnicity around hearing loss too, and it does vary around the prevalence. So for people, some people will have hearing loss and an activity which may increase their level. For example, in the Asian cultures, Māori Pacifica, obesity plus hearing loss is a huge risk for developing dementia. And for Europeans, it's hearing loss and activity and social isolation.
Thank you for highlighting that research, because I think people sometimes don't get it, and they're reluctant to go and get tested. They're reluctant to wear hearing aids. They think they can manage. Oh, I'm not bad enough yet. And yet, really, it's that early stage when they need to step up and actually be brave and be bold and get on with it and have the benefits.
Well, that's right. There's also a cost factor, isn't there? Mm. We all know hearing aids are very expensive, and so that's probably a deterrent for much of our population as well.
I think that's why Carolyn has made a deliberate effort to flag this, because the cost is the most predominant barrier to the uptake. Yes, attitude is one problem, but the cost is something else. And because There are some companies that are offering different models of service, like they're offering a lease where you can actually pay 90 cents a day and you don't own the hearing aid, but you also don't have old stale technology hanging around, because every three That's years right. you get an update automatically, and you're not paying thousands of dollars for something so that if you die within 5 years or so, you haven't wasted all that money.
Or they get lost.
Yes, they get lost or they get damaged because the grandchild's ridden the trike over them.
Or you've gone swimming or something.
Yes.
That's right, absolutely right. So I think that's a huge area for some more exploration.
I do think there's some exciting things happening out there. So having this report highlight this is really valuable. Now, looking at elder care across the globe and seeing what is happening in different places, there does seem to be really good standards of care in some countries, and some countries have companies that do extremely well. And the ratio of the staffing to the beds was what was attractive to me, because I saw that in the Netherlands and the companies they have there that operate across Italy and Spain and Belgium, they have one worker to every two beds.
That's quite extraordinary. So I think we're coming back to mandating or the expectation of how many care force and registered nurses there would be for each resident or number of residents, that's right. But I think too, we still need to come back to look at the training of the staff, the understanding of aged care, the understanding of themselves, that giving them an opportunity to be empowered with knowledge, leadership skills, self-managing teams. I think there's a huge need for that. It's working really well in some areas of the world. Australia's starting to work into that area now. So it's a shift away, a paradigm shift, I suppose, from the traditional model of care where the person we're looking after is the centre of everything that we do. And we talk about rest homes, we talk about nursing homes, and the word home's used, but are we providing a home where you have some agency, where you have some choice about the food that you want to eat, what time you want to get up in the morning? You don't want to go to bingo, fine, but you might like to just go bird watching, you might want to just sit in the sun. We need to start looking at that as well, but we can't introduce these ways of different ways of doing things, this paradigm shift, unless we train our staff in the community, for our services provided in the community, and in aged residential care.
Yes, the training is an integral element of any culture change program. And no matter who begins it or how it sets up or where it's flourishing, obviously leadership is critical, and the leaders have to come from somewhere. They have to be trained. You don't get the teams at the front line doing stuff if they're not going to be rewarded, if their managers are not trained in the model.
Absolutely. So that you're absolutely right. Yes, that's essential. But we have to do this. We can't keep saying, oh, that's too difficult. We can't possibly do that. We have to do that. Our elders deserve this.
We've actually reached critical decision-making up against the cliff face in a whole lot of areas in New Zealand and Aotearoa right now. I mean, it's a situation where, yeah, we never lie down and have a cup of tea, as David Longy put it, but we can't afford to nod off and go to sleep. We can't afford just to have a nap. We really have to look at this very seriously.
Indeed.
As a major emergency, because it is at that critical level now with the numbers. Because when people say about the numbers of people over 65, what they're not looking at is how many numbers are over 85. That's where the real concentrated need for additional care and additional support. But of course, the people getting on that pathway to get there, they have needs now that if they aren't addressed properly, they'll be in worse shape when they get to 85.
Perhaps. We have a lot of our elders over 85 still living in the community, most of them with social supports of some sort. We just need to ensure that that support, the companies providing that support, once again are trained, understand what it's like to be living with dementia, understanding the ageing process, empowered so that they can do the best job they possibly can and make good decisions. Well-trained, empowered staff make good decisions. And I think that's something we do need to, when we've talked about this, haven't we, that this needs to be addressed. I think once again too, we need to, as groups of people, we need to get together. Funding needs to be addressed, absolutely.
I mean, we're at a point where we've got infrastructure needs, and most of us recognise that in the transport sector with the road congestion, and the housing sector with the housing crisis, those things stand out to us. But the knowledge of the aged care sector and just how critical things are, it doesn't really hit home until you have somebody that you love that's faced with this acute bed shortage, that's faced with having to wait for someone to die so they can actually get into care. And yes, and people in the family struggling to look after and do that care.
It is difficult for a lot of people to navigate this. Once again, we've highlighted too in a project we did for the CMA on the North Shore that so many people don't know where to look for services. They don't know how to access services. We've still got 27%, I think it is, of New Zealanders who are not online. I don't know the percentage of our elders within that 27%, but it can be very isolating. If you don't, if you're an elder, a solo ager, they call them, who are on their own, don't have family, don't have a spouse or a partner, there's a high percentage of people in that situation too that need to be accessed. And how are we going to get to people? How are we going to get the services that we are able to provide known to these people?
Yes, there is more available digitally, but again, it's an awareness thing about whether people know. I am very impressed with digitalseniors.co.nz. Digitalseniors.co.nz offers free one-on-one coaching, and you can go to them and they'll help you search online for things. And I noticed that HealthPoint, that used to be a source of information, is now called Healthify, and you can access it free, data free, on your phone if it's a smartphone, and you just go to zero.government and into Google, and that will give you then free access to any government department you need to contact, basically, for any information.
That's wonderful.
So on that note, we're going to finish, and in a few weeks' time I hope that we'll have Carolyn Cooper with us talking about elder abuse, and this is an area in her role which is not highlighted in the report, because obviously she's interested in the actual strategy of how we move forward in the sector.
That's right.
But elder abuse is a specialist area which she will comment on in future. Okay. Thank you very much. Bye, everyone.
Get together with Senior Focus next Sunday at 5:25 p.m. on Planet FM 104.6, or listen online at any time at planetaudio.org.nz/Senior Focus. And do note, Senior Focus is one word.